Asking the right question can greatly impact your future. So are you working with a certified financial planner? A CFP professional? Certified Financial Planner certification is the standard of excellence in financial planning. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Today on Inside Politics, history on the Hill. For the first time in nearly 150 years, a cabinet member will be tried in the Senate for high crimes and misdemeanors. We're minutes away from the start of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas' impeachment trial, which could be over soon after it starts, since the real GOP target is the president's border policies. Plus, a salesman, a teacher, and a nurse walk into a courtroom. We have new details on the seven people picked so far to be jurors in the matter of the people of the state of New York versus Donald J. Trump. And, quote, Israel makes its own decisions. That's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's message to the world and his own political coalition as we wait for his war cabinet to decide how to respond to Iran's massive aerial assault. We are live in Tel Aviv this hour. I'm Dana Bash. Let's go behind the headlines and inside politics. You're looking at live pictures of the Senate floor, where senators will soon be sworn in as jurors to hear the impeachment case against President Biden's Homeland Security Secretary. Now, after that, we don't quite know how this is going to play out. Democrats may call for a quick vote to dismiss the charges, even as Republicans demand a full trial. Conviction and removal requires 67 votes, so there's pretty much no question here about the eventual outcome. CNN's Manu Raju is on Capitol Hill. Manu, you've been talking to senators. What's your sense of how this is going to play out?
You know, it could end quickly, as you mentioned. There has been negotiations that have been happening for several days among the Republican and Democratic leadership to try to have some structure on the Senate floor. Remember, the Senate operates on a principle known as unanimous consent. That means all 100 senators have to agree to how a debate could happen. That includes during an impeachment trial. But there is no agreement yet on how this could play out. Democrats had proposed, and Republicans had came back with potentially having a couple of votes to try to call for a full-blown trial. Those votes would have gone down along party lines. We'll see if that eventually happens. And then ultimately there'll be a move to dismiss the charges altogether. But there hasn't even been an agreement on that, even though the eventual outcome is certain that Alejandro Mayorkas will be essentially acquitted here in the United States Senate, and there'll be these charges will be dismissed by this Democratic-led majority. But since there's no agreement, Dana, it could be that they open up the floor and they could quickly move to end the proceedings almost immediately. We'll see if that happens. It's a little uncertain at this moment. Now, the question, too, how will this play out on the campaign trail? There are a number of vulnerable Democratic senators who will vote, most likely to vote to dismiss these charges altogether. And Republicans say they're going to make them pay for this at the polls.
It may be a rare moment of accountability, and that's, I think, maybe an opportunity here. I don't think they'll be able to run and hide from their complicity in aiding and abetting the Biden border crisis.
It's a partisan exercise, and I think it's a waste of people's time, but we have to go through it.
And Casey is not, Bob Casey there, who you just heard from, is not the only vulnerable Democrat who will cast this key vote. Others to watch, including Senator John Tester of Montana. He had indicated previously that he would vote to dismiss this, and he suggested he would look at this a little further. We'll see how he ultimately votes. Sherrod Brown of Ohio, another one to watch. Jackie Rosen of Nevada, among those Democrats. But expect most of them, if not all of them, to vote to dismiss. Will they pick up any Republicans who will oppose this as well? Another senator to watch. On the Republican side, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who has blasted these proceedings, suggested there's no reason to charge Alejandro Mayorkas with a high crime and misdemeanor over essentially a policy dispute. So that's going to be the debate. But Dana, the outcome we know, Alejandro Mayorkas will be acquitted here in a matter of minutes.
Dana. Okay, Manu, thank you so much. And the politics are very interesting, despite the outcome that we know. I want to talk more about that with PBS NewsHour's Laura Barone Lopez, Susan Glasser of The New Yorker, and our very own Kristen Holmes. Thank you so much, everybody. I want to just kind of pick up where Manu left off, which is the notion of why this is happening and what it really means. This is happening because Republicans are trying to find every avenue that they can to highlight and politicize the very real border problems, but put it on Joe Biden's plate. And this is a way that they have done it in the House by actually impeaching the Homeland Security Secretary. But now that the question is how the trial will happen, how quickly it will happen, is whether or not they can use it against these vulnerable Democrats in the Senate.
You know, Dana, I mean, Donald Trump sees immigration as the reason he won the White House in 2016. It is at the core of what he's trying to say. He has, in effect, used the House, controlled very tenuously by Republicans, as almost an extension and an arm of his campaign. So I would see this in the context of the 2024 presidential campaign. But, you know, there's a reason that this has only happened once before in our history, that a cabinet secretary has been impeached and hasn't been tried since then. You know, it's going to come and go very quickly. And up until the sort of transformation of impeachment into a really partisan tool in the last few years, there was a sense that, you know, both parties had an incentive not to, in effect, criminalize their arguments over policy by putting cabinet secretaries like this in the hot seat. I think it's going to come and go so quickly. It will be seen ultimately as a not very successful kind of political gambit by the House Republicans.
And it is political. I mean, that is sort of objectively true. And even listening to Republican senators talking about kind of the way that they are going to use this, knowing that it ultimately either will be dismissed quickly or eventually he will be acquitted. Listen to some of those Republican senators.
If they take a weaselly way out of this, if they betray our constitutional obligation to the Senate, I think we have an obligation on our side to make clear that that's not okay.
I think all of us should stand up and say, if we're not going to get a trial, then everything's on the table.
By the way, he may regret this a lot sooner than he thinks.
I believe he was talking about Chuck Schumer.
I agree. I mean, look, I think there's a couple things going on here. One is, just to reiterate what Susan said, Donald Trump not only believes that immigration helped propel him to the White House in 2016, he also thinks it's going to bring him back to the White House in 2024. And they want to double down on all this. And Republicans are following suit, not just because it's Donald Trump, but because they see the poll numbers coming out that immigration is a top issue right now for voters. And the people that you just heard from, the senators that you just heard from, those are not necessarily moderate senators who are coming up to the microphone to talk about this. But I do think that overall, this is a way for Republicans, and what they're viewing this as, a way to highlight the border crisis, a way to put that forward. Maybe people don't actually care about the impeachment of Mayorkas. Maybe people aren't really even paying attention to what is going on in the Senate right now. What they are paying attention to is what's happening at the border.
Let's look at one of the examples that Manu gave about one of the most vulnerable incumbent Democratic senators. It's John Tester of Montana. This is the kind of thing he's facing from his opponents back home.
Now they're surging the border after Tester voted to let President Biden stop building Trump's wall and voted repeatedly to fund sanctuary cities like New York. Tell Senator Tester, stop supporting Biden's border disaster.
Yeah, immigration is certainly going to be something that Republicans go after vulnerable Senate Democrats on like that. You'll notice they weren't talking about Mayorkas impeachment in that ad. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the White House right now is feeling pretty confident. They feel like the American public isn't really paying attention to this impeachment proceeding. And they also look towards that New York special election that Democrats won, that Tom Suozzi won back that seat, where he used immigration and talked about immigration, saying that Republicans weren't willing to vote for a border deal, killed the bipartisan border deal, and that Democrats were willing to sign on to one of the most conservative immigration bills in decades, and that Republicans are ultimately the ones that tanked it. So you may very well see some candidates like Tester and other vulnerable Democrats try to use that argument.
Immigration has, for months and months and months, played into what the House Speaker was grappling with, how he would deal with funding for Ukraine and Israel, particular Ukraine. Now it looks like he is going to move several bills that will finally give, let's just really focus on Ukraine right now, Ukraine the money that it says it desperately needs in order to
to stay in the game and to fight back against against Russia. What is your sense of just sort of the we're going to get to the policy in a bit, but the politics of this for Mike Johnson?
Yeah, well, I mean, it might be the thing that ends his very short tenure as Speaker. You know, right now, I think that's not likely, but he is under threat, not only from Marjorie Taylor Greene, but remember that it takes only one or two Republicans at this point to potentially take down the Speaker. The fragility and the narrowness of this House majority, of course, is one thing that's been powering the dysfunction. It's how they took out already one Republican Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. It took weeks for them to settle on this obscure, almost unknown candidate, Mike Johnson. You know, I think there's a lot of incentive in both the Republican and the Democratic caucuses right now not to have another costly internal fight. But I think it's important, Dana, that you started this conversation about Ukraine by talking about the border, because Republicans had this kind of extraordinary strategy. They've delayed a vote on this for essentially nearly 6 months now. In this period of time, Ukrainians have run out of crucial ammunition. Mm-hmm. They've run out of air defense supplies at a time when Russia is launching incredible barrages against the civilian population and energy infrastructure of Ukraine, and all because Mike Johnson essentially couldn't assemble a governing majority in his own house. So his bluff is being called right now. Remember, Senate Republicans' bluff was called. They said, we want a border deal in order to move Ukraine. It didn't happen.
He is saying, the Speaker is saying, that along with the other measures for all of this international funding, he will do a version of the original border. But we'll see what it looks like. We don't know yet. But as that's happening, our great team on Capitol Hill, they are reporting effectively that the sort of sharks are circling and that there are other Republicans, Tom Emmer, for example, who is trying to see if maybe this time, if Mike Johnson is ousted, he can get the gavel. What do you think the chances are that Mike Johnson survives?
I think that if this motion to vacate is ultimately raised, and I know that there are a handful of Republicans now saying that they're going to bring it forward, that it would be very difficult for him to survive without the help of Democrats. Mm-hmm. So, and then ultimately, does he actually want the help of Democrats? Because, you know, for so long, others before him have said that they wouldn't want Democrats to help them, effectively feeling as though it would make them a weaker speaker within their party. So he may ultimately decide that it's better to go down rather than have Democratic help. And then again, at that point, who ultimately gets the votes to become Speaker?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to imagine it being Democratic support or not. It's hard to imagine having a weaker hand than he does now just because of the slim majority. Everybody stand by. 7 down, 11 to go. Jury selection is moving rapidly in the criminal case against Donald Trump. What do we know about the jurors so far? That's next.
Asking the right question can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So are you working with a certified financial planner, a CFP professional who meets rigorous education, training, and ethical standards, and is committed to serving your best interests to prepare you for a more secure future? Certified Financial Planner Certification is the standard of excellence in financial planning. That's why it's gotta be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life,
I'm a health reporter and have been for 15 years. And even I feel overwhelmed by some of the things I read about the stuff we're eating.
My colleague Meg Terrell wanted to take a deep dive into something you've probably heard a lot about recently, ultra-processed foods. There is a lot to learn there, some fascinating stuff, and some of it is probably going to change the way you shop. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
We could be just a few days away from opening statements in the New York criminal trial of Donald Trump. Jury selection is moving at a brisk pace with 7 seated already. They need 11 more, which includes 6 alternates. Here's what we know. Juror number 1 will be the foreman. He's originally from Ireland, works in sales, has some college education, and is married with no children. Juror number 2 is an oncology nurse and native New Yorker. She lives with her fiancé and says she reads the New York Times and watches CNN. Juror number 3 is a corporate lawyer originally from Oregon. He says he gets his news from the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Google. Juror number four is Puerto Rican and runs an IT business for training and consulting. He told the court he finds Trump, quote, fascinating. Juror number five is an African-American English teacher who says she wasn't aware Trump is facing charges in other criminal cases. Juror number six is a recent college grad. She's working as a software engineer at a large broadcast company. Juror number seven is a lawyer who's married with two kids and lives on the Upper East Side in Manhattan. CNN legal analyst Carrie Cardero joins me now. Carrie, thanks so much for being here. What's your sense of the jury makeup so far?
Well, it's a cross-section of New Yorkers, a variety of backgrounds, a variety of professional affiliations, family situations. And so that represents the jury system, that represents New York. And really, the court has, I think, in this early part of the week, moved pretty expeditiously in this process to get the jury seated.
No doubt. Obviously, this is very high profile. The individual jurors, we obviously don't know their names or anything more, but we the fact that we have a sense of who they are means that there will be a lot of attention on them eventually. Now, again, sort of anonymously, but eventually, how will that play into how this is going to go down, do you think?
Well, hopefully the identities of these juries will remain confidential. And that's so important for their impartiality, for their security, for their ability to serve out the course of this trial, which will go on for several weeks, we expect. So we have this sort of background information about them. I do think one of the challenges that the lawyers on both sides will be facing in selecting the remaining jurors and in going into selecting these already seated jurors is that they want to make sure that everybody is being truthful, that nobody sort of sneaks into the jury with views that they are not expressing. The entire integrity of the system relies on truthfulness. And so it just will be so important that the lawyers continue to try to delve into private views the individuals might have.
God, that is such an important point. We do, at a certain point, just as Americans, have to take a leap of faith that everybody agrees that the jury system in the justice system is so important. Thank you so much. Appreciate that, Carrie.
Thanks.
So what does Donald Trump think of his jury so far? Here he is last night at a campaign stop in Harlem after the court day ended.
What kind of juror in your mind is an ideal juror in this
Anybody
trial?
That's fair.
Do you believe that the jury is seated today?
I'll let you know after the trial,
really
depending on that.
My panel is back. I mean, classic. Are they fair? I'll let you know after the trial. And something tells me if he's convicted, the answer will be no.
Yeah, I think you could probably say that's 100% true. I think Donald Trump was surprised yesterday during the actual jury selection that there were people who seemed to read his books or who said that they were fascinated by him or actually said that they leaned Republican, because he has been so convinced privately and publicly that he was not going to be able to find anyone in New York City who liked him at all. But again, I think what Carrie's point was, and this is something that I have heard from sources both in the prosecution and defense, both sides are really worried about the fact that because Donald Trump is so polarizing, that there is potential for people to be dishonest because they want to either support him in this trial, trying to possibly get a hung jury. That's really the best outcome that the Trump team thinks that they're going to get out of this case. Or on the other side, sneaking in because they don't like him and they want to convict him. And it is interesting to me in this particular case how aware everybody is of the fact that just because Donald Trump is so polarizing, it has become a concern on both sides.
It really is. You were with him in New York, not just at the courthouse, but when he went to Harlem for an impromptu campaign stop of sorts. I want you to listen to what he said.
I've never thought I'd see a time when I'm going through.
That was Joe Biden, obviously, not Donald Trump. Now we'll play Donald Trump.
Alvin Bragg does nothing. He goes after guys like Trump, who did nothing wrong. Violent criminals, murderers, they know there are hundreds of murderers all over the city. They know who they are. They don't pick them up. They go after Trump. This trial that I have now, that's a Biden trial. They want to keep me off the campaign trail. but based on what I'm doing, I think there's more press here than there is if I went out to some nice location.
Okay, we'll make a little truth open face sandwich here. It's not a Biden trial.
Obviously.
And New York City murders are down 24%. This year.
Right, but this is a really good preview of what Donald Trump is going to spend the next several weeks doing. I mean, this was a clear political stunt. This wasn't just a bodega in Harlem. This was the bodega in Harlem was at the center of an Alvin Bragg controversy in 2022 when Bragg's office decided to charge the clerk there who ended up killing a man who had jumped behind the counter and assaulted him. This led to enormous backlash throughout the state of New York, throughout the city, against Bragg for bringing these charges. This was a very calculated move, and this is really what we're going to see from Donald Trump. He can come out here and he can say over and over again that the trial is unfair, that these are the Biden trials, and we can continue to say it's obviously not true. This is a trial brought in New York State by a district attorney in New York. We can fact check it. But he's going to continue to try to utilize the public and these trials in order to get attention.
I want to switch gears to President Biden, who is on the campaign trail. He is in Pennsylvania. You saw a little bit of it. I want to, if we can, go back to some of what he said in Scranton.
I've never thought I'd see a time when I'm going through a neighborhood or a rural town in the West or Senate and see big signs that have a Trump sign in the middle that says F Biden. And having a little kid standing with his middle finger, 7 years old, 8 years old. Well, I promise it happens all the time. It's not who we are.
Yeah, I think that we saw in the swing that the president is making this week through Pennsylvania that he's really just trying to draw as many contrasts as possible, whether it's there saying that, you know, he's trying to appeal to better angels, to try to appeal to civility, to decency. That's something that he talks a lot about on the campaign trail, and that former President Trump does the opposite, where he encourages violence in some cases, normalizes, you know, talking in very degrading terms about anyone that he opposes, to the point where sometimes that can result in death threats against those people. But, and you also saw in these campaign stops that he's really trying to create this image of Scranton, Pennsylvania versus Mar-a-Lago, and that actually it's Donald Trump that is the elitist and is the person that is out of touch with America, and that President Biden comes from a town like Scranton that is much more in touch with everyday working people's needs and desires.
And on that note, he's also today going to talk some populist themes, a la Donald Trump, talking about tariffs. And before we go, I just want you and our viewers to see a brand new ad from the Biden campaign. And the name of the ad is Sharp.
Love to tell the story about meeting President Biden, because when you meet him, this guy's as sharp as a knife. They have nothing else to attack because they can't attack the things that he's doing that are so good for this country. Joe Biden gets things done. That's just who he is.
I mean, that says it all. Again, that is from the Biden campaign, and the name of the ad is Sharp. We're going to have to leave this part of the discussion where it is. Thank you so much. You stick around, Susan. Israel is weighing a response to Iran's weekend attack. The U.S. plans brand new sanctions against Tehran. We're going to go live to Tel Aviv after a quick break. As the world waits for Israel's response to Iran's massive missile and drone attacks, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu delivered this message.
I thank our friends for their support for the defense of Israel. And I say this, both support in words and support in actions. They also have all kinds of suggestions and advice. I appreciate it, but I want to make it clear. We will make our own decisions, and the state of Israel will do everything necessary to defend itself.
CNN's Jeremy Diamond is live in Tel Aviv. Jeremy, good to see you. The way I saw and read and interpreted those comments was that they were more directed for domestic political consumption in Israel, maybe, than people abroad. What are you hearing from your sources there?
Yeah, no doubt about it, Dana. That is kind of Netanyahu's bread and butter, that signature defiance that he employs at moments where he is coming under enormous pressure, both internationally as well as domestically. And this is certainly, in part at least, intended for a domestic political audience, for the right wing of his governing coalition, who has been putting enormous pressure on him to carry out a very significant retaliatory strike against Iran for that unprecedented attack that Iran carried out over the weekend. It is also, of course, a message to allies to a certain extent that he will ultimately make his own decisions. But at the same time, Netanyahu is mindful of the fact that the United States, that so many of these other countries in the region assisted Israel in the successful aerial defense effort over the weekend that succeeded in taking out 99% of those drones and missiles that were fired against Israel. And so it certainly is part of the calculus for the Israeli prime minister, despite the bluster that he is talking about here about Israel making its own decisions. There's certainly part of the calculus and part of the discussions in the war cabinet over the course of the last week has centered around how much does Israel need to take the United States and other allies' concerns into account. And there's no question that Israel has been coming under significant pressure from the United States and those other countries, including the United Kingdom and Germany, whose foreign ministers are in Israel today, if they do carry out a retaliatory strike, to ensure that it is measured and to ensure that it does not lead to an all-out war between Iran and Israel, something that would be very destabilizing, of course, for the entire region.
So you mentioned the prime minister's cabinet and his political allies. What about the people on the ground, his constituents broadly in Israel? What's the sentiment there?
Well, it ties into what we're hearing from the United States, too. I mean, President Biden's message to Netanyahu has been, look, take the win. And there is certainly a feeling of a win here in Israel in terms of that successful aerial defense effort. And because of the success of that and how much the United States' role really has been touted in Israeli media over the course of the last several days, the latest poll, which was conducted over the last couple of days by Hebrew University, finds that 74% of those polled believe that a retaliatory strike against Iran should not take place if it undermines Israel's security alliances with its allies. 26% were in favor of an attack, even if it were to damage ties with allies. So it's less about whether or not Israel should respond, but how that response should be kind of framed within the context of those concerns by allies, and certainly in terms of the concerns being voiced by the United States. Dana.
Okay, Jeremy, thank you so much for that reporting. Susan Glasser of The New Yorker is still with me. The other dynamic that we didn't even mention in my conversation with Jeremy, of course, is that Israel is still very much at war in Gaza. How much is that playing into what it's dealing with as it grapples with how to respond, if to respond to Iran?
Well, that's right. Look, I think for Israel, first of all, it's been a welcome respite for months and months of, you know, increasingly negative coverage, increasingly negative headlines and great concerns from its allies, never mind its adversaries, about the way in which Israel's conducting the war in Gaza. That scrutiny has temporarily ebbed as people have focused more on the question of this brewing conflict with Iran. One of the focuses of the Biden administration's diplomacy over the last few months, much of it not necessarily visible to us, has been avoiding what they view as a really catastrophic outcome of a broader regional conflict. Iran would be at the center of that. They've pointed out that it's really different to have Iran orchestrate strikes from its own territory even than to operate through proxies like Hamas and Hezbollah.
Susan, we talked earlier in the program about Ukraine and about the desperate sense of need for help from the U.S. For months and months and months, perhaps the House is on the cusp of passing some aid. You were talking in the break about the connection there from the view inside Ukraine.
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, politically here in Washington, I do think, you know, this strike by Iran over the weekend, it increased the pressure on Republicans to bring this national security bills, now plural, to the floor. One will be on Israel, one will be on Ukraine. For Ukrainians, these conflicts are linked. And I think that's something that doesn't always break through here in Washington. First of all, for many Ukrainians who are under daily assault by Russian missile barrages of exactly the kind that these drones that were launched and ballistic missiles that were launched from Iran, these are the same things that Russians are using to attack Ukrainians every day. And you don't have U.S. fighter jets in the air. You don't have U.S. air defense. And because of the Republican delay on Capitol Hill for more than 6 months, really, the result has been Ukraine running out of ammunition or air defense that they could use themselves.
Really interesting. Thank you so much. Always good to see you, Susan.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Ahead, a new level of dysfunction, if you can believe that, on Capitol Hill. Hardline Republicans are threatening to take down another speaker if he doesn't bend to their will. The question at this point is, will Democrats step in to save him? We're going to talk to a Democratic congressman coming up.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Pressure is building on House Speaker Mike Johnson over foreign aid and a number of bills that he is trying to push through. And Republicans now are being more vocal as they learn the plan that he is going to push forward. It looks like through this weekend, separate votes for foreign aid to Israel and Ukraine. His speakership still seems to be very much at stake. CNN's Manu Raju is with me now. Manu, you've been talking to some of the people in the conference who are not very happy.
Yeah, those are the members of the hard right, the members of the House Freedom Caucus. I just caught up with a number of them. They are angry, and some of them are suggesting that they could be open to pushing out Mike Johnson, supporting the effort led by Marjorie Taylor Greene to oust him from the speakership over these bills that have just been released in the last matter of minutes to provide this key aid to the U.S. allies. Now, one of them, Congressman Chip Roy, now meeting with Mike Johnson, and I asked him about whether or not he's ready to oust Mike Johnson from the job. And he said he's got needs some more time to think about it. Listen.
Met for hours last night and proposed different paths for the speaker that would have avoided the abject surrender represented by his strategic choice here. There's no other way to describe it. It's surrender. It's disappointing. I won't support it.
It's disappointing. It's completely detached from what our base wants, what our voters want.
The strategy is not to try. I think the strategy is to fall on his sword.
So when I asked Congressman Chip Roy about whether or not it was time for him to oust Mike Johnson from the speakership, he said that he went right up to the line, Dana, and didn't go across that line, perhaps because he needs to talk with the speaker, which is happening right now. Now, the question is, will the numbers add up to oust him from the speakership? Because Democrats, as you mentioned, could step in to save him because of what he's doing here on Ukraine. So this is a different situation than the fall when McCarthy was ousted from the speakership. But no doubt about it, Mike Johnson opening up a revolt on the far right with his conference, with this move here.
Yeah. I mean, we just saw it just right there, what you played for us. Manu, thanks so much. Always great to have you on. Joining me now here in the studio is New Jersey Democratic Congressman Josh Gottheimer. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Anna.
React to what you just heard from your fellow congresspeople across the aisle, abject surrender. You know how narrow the Republican majority is. It's going to mean that Democrats are going to have to help pass this support for Israel, the support for Ukraine and beyond. Do you think it's going to happen?
Well, a lot of this is more of the same, right? This is the same group of people that no matter what happens, they throw bombs, right? The same foreign extremists. And it's why Democrats, Republicans, a group, have had to work together consistently to actually legislate, right? To keep the government open, to prevent a debt ceiling problem over and over again. That's what we've been focused on. And right now, we know that we have several crises going on in the world that we've got to deal with, right? And the easiest thing would be to take the bill that the Senate sent us with 70 votes and put it on the floor and pass it. You have Democrats and Republicans coming together to make sure there's resources for Ukraine, for Israel, humanitarian aid, Taiwan.
But you saw why the speaker's not doing it.
Right, but he keeps trying all these other machinations, and guess what? The bomb throwers keep throwing bombs. No matter what he tries to give them, you're back in the same place.
So will these bills, I know we haven't seen them yet, but assuming we will soon, actually pass this Saturday, which is the current plan?
Well, so the first thing is you got to see them. And if they are, I'll say this, if they are consistent and the language that the Senate sent over with 70 votes, Democrats and Republicans, but they're broken up in pieces, of course I could see that actually passing. You could see an overwhelming number of Democrats and Republicans coming together to get it done. The thing I worry about between now and then is it's open to amendments. So what amendments will some of the folks you just saw try to add to the bills? Mm-hmm. Will they pass? Because if you put a poison pill in, right, the whole thing blows up. And that's what we're all worried about.
I want you to listen to what some of your fellow Democrats have said about the increasingly likely prospect that Republicans will try to oust Mike Johnson from the speaker's chair.
I will vote to keep Johnson as speaker. Just do your job and put it on the floor and let's get this thing done already.
I think it's unlikely I would support vacating it.
If Marjorie Taylor Greene, someone who wants states to secede from the union, brings up a motion to vacate, I will not support her doing that under any circumstance. Democrats don't even let her rename post offices. I'm not going to let her make a motion to vacate.
Will you join them? Will you effectively side with, it looks like, the majority of Republicans and support Mike Johnson to stay in the speaker's chair?
Right now, I'm not making that commitment until I think it's putting the cart before the horse. I got to see how this actually plays out. Does it get done? Does he do the right thing? Part of my frustration now is we've waited 2 months. He's had this Senate bill. He could be helping Ukraine. He could be helping get humanitarian aid and help Israel, which is critically important, especially after Iran's attack this weekend. We know that Ukraine is literally outgunned 5-1. Right? They don't have defensive measures. They're being depleted. So we have a huge crisis going on multiple fronts, plus in Taiwan, a huge challenge from our number one adversary,
China. So you're not giving
China.
Him your support for free.
I want to actually see, does something get done here? He could have brought this to the floor. Will this proposal work that he's trying? Like, if he did it the right way, I guarantee you'd have a lot of people supporting him. The question is, will he get this done? And then you can ask me that question.
Okay, but you're obviously open to it.
I want to see what happens. I don't put the cart before the horse.
Okay. You yesterday were a co-sponsor of a resolution that passed that condemned the chant "From the River to the Sea" as blatantly anti-Semitic. It passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives. Today, there are representatives from Columbia University, other administrators on Capitol Hill. They're being asked questions about what they view as anti-Semitic. I'm waiting to listen to some of what's happening.
Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Columbia's code of conduct? Mr. Greenwald.
Yes, it does.
Ms. Shipman.
Yes, it does.
Dr. Shafiq.
Yes, it does.
And Professor Schizer.
Yes, it does.
Your reaction?
Well, that's obviously, given that I helped author that resolution, I thought that calling for the destruction of Israel from the river to the sea and the elimination of the Jewish people as anti-Semitic. I think there's never been a question about that. And yesterday, Congress overwhelmingly affirmed it. And now you see today, the Columbia University, all these representatives from Columbia also said this is a violation of our code of conduct and unacceptable.
It's quite different from a few months ago when it was
Yes, when
hard
people were equivocating and unsure whether or not it was. And I thought that was outrageous then, and I'm glad they followed up today.
We are about to enter commencement season. You saw what happened at USC, that the valedictorian was asked not to speak. They said it was security concerns. She did post allegedly some statements on her social media page talking about the abolition of Israel. Just quickly, are you concerned about these kinds of speeches that we're going to see over and over?
Yeah, I'm not close enough. I haven't spoken I put a call in to the university to find out more details and obviously to understand more about the security issues, because that's always my number one concern. Mm-hmm. But listen, I think we're entering a time where we have to make it clear that calls for genocide and the elimination of people, by the way, if it's Islamophobia, if it's anti-Semitism, which numbers have spiked off the chart, mm-hmm. right, in my home state of New Jersey, huge problem, like one of the largest problems in the country right now. We've got to make sure we come together again. We've got to tamp this down, and we've got to focus on what brings us together, not on all this hatred.
Congressman, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. We'll be right back. Before we go, we have some very exciting news here at Inside Politics. We want to welcome Luke William Filkins to the IP family. He was born on Saturday, weighing in at a mighty 7 pounds, 1 ounce, and 18.5 inches long. Congratulations to our producer, Courtney Pence, her husband, John, and of course, Luke's big sister, Emmy, on the newest addition to their sweet family. Thank you so much for joining Inside Politics. CNN News Central starts after the break.
Asking the right question can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So are you working with a certified financial planner, a CFP professional who meets rigorous education, training, and ethical standards and is committed to serving your best interests to prepare you for a more secure future? Certified Financial Planner Certification is the standard of excellence in financial planning. That's why it's gotta be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832 and tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.